Welcome to Season 13, Episode 19 of the Ubuntu Podcast. It's Thursday, the 30th of July. Thursday, I hear you say? Well, yes. Sorry about this. We're a little bit late this week, although we've been trying our hardest to make sure we get every show this season out on time, especially given our lovely Patreons who have been contributing to our production costs to ensure that we do so. We had some unforeseen staff sickness this week, which meant that we had to delay the recording by a couple of days. But hopefully it shouldn't delay it getting to you too much. So thank you to everyone over at patreon.com/UbuntuPodcast. Do stay subscribed, please. This should be a one-off. In this show, we're going to go over what we've been up to. We're going to have some Ubuntu community news, and we're going to have some news headlines. And joining me this week, as ever, Martin and Alan.
Who goes first? Hello.
That threw us. You're going off script, Mark.
I did that just to see what you'd do.
We both locked up, divide by zero.
both look startled and confused.
Martin, what have you been up to in the last couple of weeks?
I have been making an Ubuntu remix for retro gamers.
Ooh. Is it limited to only the Commodore 64, or will other games be able to be played?
No, you can play other games, but they all look like the Commodore 64. Everything's brown and beige. You love to rub in my face.
So is this not just RetroPie?
Kind of, yes. Certainly inspired by. So, I suppose I need to explain why I'm making... I'm not making a distribution. It's always going to be a remix. But I've got a whole bunch of Raspberry Pis specifically set up for different console emulation. Mm-hmm. And I could just stick RetroPie on it and be done. And that would be fabulous. And that's what I've done in the past. But I haven't learned anything by doing that, because RetroPie does all the heavy lifting for you. And there's also a second motivation here, which is we've been putting loads of effort into making the Raspberry Pi experience on Ubuntu really great at work. And I was like, I want this to run Ubuntu. So the idea here is that I've got these dedicated cases and hats and things for retro gaming, and I want to make a remix that's dedicated to each of those cases and cabinets and gaming hat modules and all the rest of it.
Nice.
Because I want to learn what's involved in actually making, you know, a Raspberry Pi emulate classic arcade games and consoles.
So it's more for fun and edumacational rather than, optimize. Sounds like you want to try and optimize the emulator so it runs really super well under Ubuntu, right?
Yes, exactly that. And, you know, and sort of a tertiary benefit is by doing this, I get to find some of the edge cases where maybe we haven't got things quite right with, you know, the hardware enablement on the Raspberry Pi and Ubuntu, and I can flag that up and we can get that fixed and improve it. I'm learning loads and I'm having loads of fun, and I've kind of delayed the point at which I can just sit down and play some games, unfortunately, because I've got to make the whole thing work. But I've been having lots of fun getting there.
Excellent. Alan, what have you been doing?
I have been playing E.T. Legacy. It's nothing to do with the extraterrestrial.
Huh. this isn't the Atari game that's buried in the desert, then.
No, it is not. But it's similarly old. It's a kind of re-implementation, remake of Return to Castle Wolfenstein Enemy Territory, which was a game that was very popular about 10 or... Well, I mean,
10?
It had a resurgence 10 years ago. It was really popular maybe 15 years ago. But Enemy Territory, the Lug Radio podcast fans used to have an Enemy Territory server that was spun up by someone in the community on a Wednesday night and a Sunday night. And I used to really enjoy sitting down on a Wednesday night and shooting my friends in the head from across the map. It's a bunch of... maps that you play in rotation, and I've been playing E.T. Legacy because one of the guys who still lurks in the IRC channel for a podcast that died 10 years ago decided, let's spin up a server. And so I've been playing a little bit of E.T. Legacy, and it brought back some good memories. And there's a lot of fun to be had, and there's still people who play it now. If you jump on Enemy Territory servers, there's still people actively playing the game.
And are there any roguelike elements?
No, there are no roguelike elements in this particular game. It's all shooty, shooty, bang, bang, and putting mines down. And the best part is it's Axis powers versus the allies. And I love some of the phrases. There are little phrases you can say. You can press a keyboard shortcut in order to, you know, say yes and yavul and stuff like that. And fires a railgun and stuff. It's...
Sounds a little bit inappropriate, but okay.
Well, it's a game, you know, it's a game representing the past. And for those of us who like that, it's jolly good fun. So I would highly recommend ET Legacy. If you want to play with other like-minded people, join #LugRadio on Freenode IRC, which the fact that it's old technology, you know, this Discord stuff, join IRC, #LugRadio, and we'll... talk in there about when the next Lug Radio night of enemy territory is.
Cool. Right, let's get on with the show. And now it's time for some community news. And first up in the community news this week, Digicam 7.0.0 has been released.
Ooh.
So Digicam is the KDE... photo and image management software.
Yeah, it's like the thing you'd use to collect all your photos together and process them a bit and, you know, organize them and maybe put them in folders and edit them in small ways. It's not like the GIMP, is it? It's you know, minimal editing, isn't it?
It's a photo organizer.
Right.
Yeah. And that's all I've known the name for years, and that's all I've assumed it was, just a photo organizer. But reading through the release notes, I have to say, I'm rather impressed. It's got some pretty swanky features, and the improvements in this release are impressive. The one that stands out is, and they probably dedicate about half the release notes to, because they've clearly done a lot of work on, is it has improved facial recognition, which obviously could sound creepy, of course, but this is running locally on your own machine as opposed to using some, you know, cloud-based AI. And rather amusingly, they have a whole passage there about how it works with some of your pets as well.
Yeah.
So you can categorize your cat photos with extreme efficiency.
Yeah.
Do you know if it does the thing where it recognizes that these are pictures of this person?
Yeah.
And so you only have to train it on a few photos, and then from that point onwards that's a photo of Alan, or that's a photo of Martin.
Exactly. Yeah, I was looking at how it worked, and once you've trained a face, then it automatically creates like a label which is sort of hierarchical, and then you can just go and say, show me or find all of the pictures of Alan, and there will be your happy smiley face in all of the pictures.
It's interesting. I used to use Digicam quite heavily a long, long time ago when I used KDE, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. It really felt like a really powerful, well-engineered piece of software. And I don't remember ever having problems with it. I just moved away from KDE, and for some reason, I moved away from managing my photos using Digicam. I think at some point I used Shotwell as well, and I used to just point the software at my giant photo collection, all these gigabytes of photos, and it would just suck all the photos up and then show them to me in like date order or grouped by event or something. It was just, Digicam is just a really, really nice piece of software, and it also doesn't make the mistake of putting the K at the beginning of the application name. So Digicam, you kind of get an idea of what it is, and it actually manages to slip a uppercase K in the middle of the name.
Yeah. And also you mentioned Shotwell. I mean, Shotwell, this is, as you say, it's way more feature complete and very much of the now, because some of the other features that they've added is support for raw photographs from all the current crop of, you know, DSLRs and mirrorless cameras, including the two that I own, and even GoPros and DJI drones, and then image format support for stuff that's on iOS devices, and a mosaic wall generator, which looks super cool. So you can take an image and then recompose it on a mosaic of all of your photographs, you know, all sort of used as like the pixels.
Oh, nice.
I thought Free Software All avoided that because that's patented by some horrible organization, that whole, well, Well, it does say it's a third-party plugin, so that may be why they don't ship it as part of the application.
Nevertheless, yeah, it's great. It feels like it's a very forward-thinking bit of software, and if I still organise my photos, I'd definitely be taking a good look at Digicam.
Excellent. Alan, what's up next?
Next is a little nugget that I found on the Ubuntu Discourse. The GNOME Shell performance hero, Daniel Van Voot, who works on the Ubuntu desktop team, he posted an interesting pair of little tips on Discourse. And it's funny, he throws these little nuggets in there, and I just happened to spot this. And one of them was a little command line, sudo dmi decode minus T17, which...
The old T17.
Yeah, you know it. And the reason he mentioned that is so you can tell if DMI decode shows you about hardware information, and this particular thing tells you about the memory. I think T is type or something, maybe. Tells you about your memory. And the point that he was making was he noticed a perceptible difference in performance of GNOME Shell whether you're using dual channel memory or not. And so if you've got a computer that's got two slots and can have dual channel DDR RAM, and you've only got one slot occupied, then if you were to put another stick of RAM in, and so thus making it dual channel, you could see a notable difference in performance. And he was throwing this out there as a way for you to see whether your RAM is configured dual channel or not, which you might not know if, you know, you're a novice or you're not a computer hardware nerd or you didn't build the computer. And so I thought that was quite an interesting nugget. Mm-hmm. But the second one he put in there, I'm personally affected by, he pointed out that laptops and desktops that have Intel integrated GPUs, there are various generations of the Intel driver. They generally start with the letter I and 935, 945, 965, and so on. And then the very latest one is called Iris, is the name of the driver in Xorg. And he threw this little line in there, single line that you can do to force the computer to use the older driver. So X uses the older driver. And the reason why this was important is because the older driver seems to be better at frequency scaling. And so you don't see as much lag when the CPU is going up and down, or the GPU is going up and down in the different frequency scalings and going into sleep modes and all that kind of stuff. So I thought I'd try that out. I haven't really necessarily noticed a difference, but I thought I'd try it out anyway because I can. And I thought other people might be interested in this as well. So we'll put a link to the thread in the notes.
Excellent. Martin, what's next?
I read with interest that there is yet another Ubuntu remix in the works. This one is simply called Ubuntu Web Remix. And the idea is to try and create a Chrome OS-alike experience using a cut-down Ubuntu and Firefox.
This is interesting. I've considered this in the past and thought, well, you know what? What would stop someone making a lightweight Linux distribution that basically booted into the most minimal desktop possible and sparked up a web browser and then use whatever tools like Nextcloud on another machine or whatever password synchronization tools where you're self-hosting to give you a Google-less Chrome OS-like experience on a modern laptop? I thought this is a great idea.
Yeah, it's not the first time. I mean, there's things like, is it Gallium OS, which I think aims to do something similar. I think that may even use Chromium as the as the browser.
Yeah, it
but
does.
There are similar things. But I like the fact that it's Rudra Saraswat who recently created the Ubuntu Unity remix and the Ubuntu Edu remix. Feel like they might be spreading themselves a little bit thin, creating a third distribution. But nevertheless, this one's very interesting. And I love the concept and the idea. I'll be interested. There is no image yet. This is in the works. I'll be interested to see how it develops and having a play with it.
It'd be interesting to see what you can put together with a stand. I mean, effectively, that's what Chrome OS is initially, was a bunch of Linux tools and utilities plus a web browser and not a lot more. And so long as you've got the necessary stuff to control network and sound and, you know, all the indicators and stuff like that, then you should be good to go.
I was experimenting with the very, very earliest Chrome OS build scripts when it was brand new, and it was based on Firefox. It was Firefox with a revised UI before, you know, Chrome and Chromium even were a twinkle in Google's eye.
Next up, Thunderbird 78 is out, boasting a much higher version number than it should. So I just checked my Thunderbird version, and it's version 68, and this is version 78. And they're saying this isn't an upgrade. You have to download it and install it separately.
Huh. Why? What? There's no migration?
They said that you won't get an in-app notification to upgrade. Presumably, if you use an external package repository, then you will. But yeah, they've said that you're not going to get an in-app notification to upgrade. And also, some things won't work, like the Enigmail extension for encryption. They said that you should use Thunderbird 78 if you rely on that for now.
But they've added, on the flip side to 78, they've added PGP support, open PGP support. So you can flick a switch and then more easily do encrypted email without having to add plugins and
yes. And nonsense. So it's built in. That Enigmail isn't necessary going forward.
But yeah.
If you already have it all configured for your stuff, then you're not just going to want to switch straight over.
It's also got the calendar integration as well. And I always see people mention Thunderbird and Lightning. Very, very frightening. But I've never seen this Lightning. I don't think I've ever tried to install it. So I don't actually know what it does. Yeah.
Is the killer feature as far as I'm concerned.
really?
Yeah. The calendar integration. I mean, it is a calendar, but when you hook it up to your online accounts that do calendars and all the rest of it, it turns Thunderbird into a very capable email client into a fully integrated sort of personal information manager, Outlook alike.
Like Evolution does already.
Yes. I mean, I've switched Ubuntu Mate to Evolution because I feel Evolution does it better, but prior to that point, I was shipping Lightning alongside Thunderbird in Ubuntu Mate in order to sort of complete that, you know, productivity suite. It's very good. Mm. It's very good.
Yeah, I'll give that a go. And it's also got dark mode support.
But not in Linux, unfortunately.
Oh.
It's dead to
Boo.
Me.
Yeah.
Alan, what's our last bit of community news?
Mir is not dead.
What?
Yeah, I know, right? nobody said this before, but Mir 2.0.0 has been released.
Version 2?
I know.
It's thoroughly alive.
I know we joke about this a lot, but the Mir developers have put out a new release, and there's nothing like leaping off the page as, you know, striking new features, but, you know, I'm sure they've worked hard on it. And there's a whole bunch of ABI changes. I noticed as they've gone from 1.0 to 2.0, some of the projects that use some of these ABIs and APIs might lose that along the way. And so it might be good for some projects to stay on 1.0 for now. And the one that's highlighted in the notes is UbiPorts, the Ubuntu Touch, as was. Is using the older interfaces to Mir for the Unity 8 desktop. I say desktop, you know, phone top. What do you call it? Shell, that's the word. And so the Mir guys have been talking to the UbiPorts guys. I know the Mir developers actually run Ubuntu Touch on their phones anyway, so they're constantly in contact with the UbiPorts guys. So, yeah, Mir not dead. Who knew? Everyone who listens to this show.
And that's the end of the community news. And now it's time for the news headlines. Martin, what's up first in the news this week?
Well, it turns out Secure Boot is not so secure.
Uh-oh.
There's a vulnerability and it has a catchy name.
Oh, good. Does it have a logo?
I don't know, actually. I didn't go looking for a logo. I spotted it had a catchy name. I just assumed it must have branding as well.
The catchy name is?
Boot Hole.
Mm. I've seen a picture of a rather tatty boot with a maggot coming out through a hole in the end. So I guess that's the logo.
Nice.
I see. So what's all this about then?
Well, it's interesting because it's sort of a two-sided story. You know, it's your typical security vulnerability in that there's a vulnerability in Grub, but actually a vulnerability in like Secure Boot. And it means that the very thing that Secure Boot is designed to do doesn't work. It is possible to inject malicious code into the boot process and completely compromise the system, which is a bit embarrassing because it, like, it had one job to do. And, you know, if you want to learn more about that, we will have a link in the show notes to a wiki article that the Ubuntu security team have prepared that talks about this in quite some detail. But also, what was interesting is security researchers identified this single issue. And then when all of the distribution maintainers and Microsoft and the like all got into working under embargoed circumstances to find a resolution to this, about seven other issues were identified as well, which have subsequently been fixed. But it's just another security vulnerability, in quotes. What's more interesting about this one is this. If you are a dual booter or a multi-booter, or you are a user that deliberately withholds updates in your distributions, or you're a user of a Linux distribution that also withholds updates, you could run out of rope pretty quickly, because if one of these updates is applied via another operating system or another distro, it could prevent your other distributions from booting.
So this is an update for the device's firmware that the operating system also has to have a corresponding update to support. Is that right?
Some of the certificates that sign the secure boot process are being revoked. So if you don't update your system to use the new, the updates that have the new certificate signing things, then you won't be able to boot them. So if you have your updates applied through Windows, then you may render your other operating systems unbootable. And that's nothing nefarious. It's just like the fact that they share, you know, this common architecture.
Right.
It's because the secure boot system has an ability to block like nefarious things that you don't want to boot, nefarious binaries. And so they're going to list all the old builds of Grub and mm-hmm. say all of these are bad. And the problem mm-hmm. is if you dual boot, then it's possible that you've got on your other partition or on your other disk, you've got one of those dodgy versions of Grub. And so if you boot your new install and that then marks old versions of Grub as being bad, the next time you try and reboot into that old version, then it will fail to boot because it won't allow that binary to boot because it's not trusted. Now, you can work around it by turning off secure boot and then you can boot into it, but you know, you're defeating the whole purpose of secure boot. I listened to the Ubuntu security podcast earlier today where Alex and Joe went through this in a lot of detail. They start off really high level and talk about what happened and how we were told that this was a problem and how everything was organized. And then they went into a deep dive of how it actually manifests itself. And it was super interesting and very accessible. And it's really worth a listen if you want to understand exactly how this happened. If you listen to the latest episode of the Ubuntu Security Podcast, it's all in there.
Yes. If you're not subscribed to the Ubuntu Security Podcast, you should be. You may have noticed in recent years, we don't cover security stories very well, very often. And that's because the Ubuntu Security Podcast does it so much better.
Yeah, I was going to say, slip of the tongue, it's because we don't do it very well.
Alan, what's up next?
I saw a nice game over the last week called Shutter Stroll. And there's a couple of things that are quite nice about this. Well, first of all, it's available for Linux. And that makes
That's
it nice.
That's always good.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it's what people affectionately call walking simulator. There's a few of these games where it feels like there's no objective or there's no, you know, there's no points system, there's no adversary, you're just going for a stroll in an environment. And there's been other games like this. Dear Esther is a very famous walking simulator, in quotes. But the idea of this is you just go for a walk around an island and you take photos, hence Shutter Stroll. You go and take photos and then you're encouraged to share those on social media or with your friends or however. And it's just a nice way to relax, to wander around taking pictures. And I thought that was nice. You know, it's a nice open world, if you like, in which you can capture the scenes that you see. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I thought was super interesting was it has an interesting mechanic for how you buy it. you can opt to pay for the game, and for every copy that's bought on itch.io, that unlocks a free copy for someone else who can't afford to buy it.
Hmm.
And I thought that was really nice. So your every purchase that's made makes it possible for someone who can't afford or is, you know, impoverished in some way or just, you know, incapable of buying it, they can unlock a free copy. I just thought that was a really innovative way to finance the game and make it possible for other people to play it too. I say play, experience the walking simulator that is Shutter Stroll.
Excellent. Next up, Microsoft is dropping support for PHP on Windows.
What does that mean?
What?
So PHP, in case you don't know, is a hugely popular programming language which is used mainly in web applications. So this is applications like WordPress, Drupal, Moodle, powering a lot of websites around the world. They're all written in PHP. And if you're on Windows, the main way of getting PHP is by downloading a binary from windows.php.net, mm-hmm. which are... so that's from the php.net is the PHP project's website, but actually windows.php.net, the builds there are built and supported by Microsoft.
Oh.
Yes. I didn't actually know that until this week, even though I use that use it at work. And they have said that from PHP version 8 onwards, so the current, I think the current stable version is PHP 7.4, and they're saying that once that's end of life, they're no longer going to be supporting these builds. They're not going to be doing new builds. They're not going to be supporting the builds ongoing for Windows.
Do they say why?
Not in the initial announcement, no. They've just said, you know, this is what you can expect from us going forward. But one thing that occurred to me when they said this was that actually there is still a supported way of running PHP on Windows, because Windows Subsystem for Linux is supported and you can run PHP on that. And a lot of the tools which you might use to write PHP on Windows are aware of WSL and integrate with it. So things like VS Code and PHP Storm,
right.
They all know that running PHP on WSL is a thing and will give you options to integrate with it.
Oh.
So I'm wondering if the reason that they've done this is to, you know, give themselves less to maintain and push people in the direction of using WSL instead.
They must know how many people grab PHP from that website.
Right.
And so I wonder if the numbers just didn't, you know, make it make sense. It's just not worth doing if there's not enough people running PHP on Windows. I'm sure there's, you know, a substantial number, but I would imagine there's way more people with WSL installed rather than PHP on Windows, maybe.
Well, that's quite possibly
wild speculation.
And it's possible there might be other community builds that people are using, or I don't know if you use something like XAMPP, which is like a bundled Apache PHP database package. I don't know if that actually uses the Microsoft builds or whether they build their own version. Mm. There's also speculation that someone might continue creating and publishing builds on windows.php.net, but that is as yet unconfirmed, I believe.
Mm, interesting.
So it's going to be interesting to see. I mean, at work, we're going to have a conversation about what we do about this now, because all of our development machines are on Windows, even though our servers aren't. So this might be a reason for us to investigate using WSL for development, but who knows? We're going to have to look into that.
Or switching your workstations to Linux.
Ha. Huh. Unfortunately, that's far less likely to happen.
Oh. That's a shame. PHP Storm is in the Snap Store.
Oh, yeah, that made you look really dejected there, Mark. So, sorry about that. And finally, Mark.
Yes, and finally.
I have found a game for you, Mark. You'll all be familiar with the desktop classic Minesweeper. Well,
I will.
Demon Crawl.
The clicking simulator.
Yeah, Demon Crawl is now available, which is a Minesweeper with roguelite elements, and it's coming to Linux.
What?
Wow.
Yeah, I can't grok this. I'm still confused by rogue like rogue light. This all means nothing to me, but I know these are words that Mark cares about. So I was sure this was going to be a hit with Mark.
So it looks like this is a dungeon crawling type game.
Don't know what that means either.
It means you're exploring a dungeon.
Okay.
and finding treasure mainly, and occasionally fighting monsters.
Gauntlet?
Yes.
Okay. Could they not just say Gauntlet-like?
Because Rogue predates Gauntlet by some margin.
And anyway, there's more specific things about being Rogue. Like, I'll explain all of these at length at some point.
Please don't.
But the cool thing about this game is it. So if you've ever played Minesweeper, you click around and it tells you, you know, next to this there are four mines and next to this square there are two mines, and you use a sort of a system of deduction to work out where it's safe to click and where it's not. And sometimes you click somewhere and then there's no mines touching any of the squares touching that, and it opens up a big area of the map. And it looks like that what this does, this game, is it uses that like empty space as a dungeon, so you might find monsters and treasure in those areas, and then you can explore further, avoiding the bombs.
Brilliant.
But unveiling, instead of unveiling nothing like you do in Minesweeper, you unveil a dungeon. So yeah, that looks quite fun, and it's already out on Windows and apparently plays through Proton, but there is a Linux version in beta available on Steam.
Brilliant. I look forward to a full review in an upcoming episode of Ubuntu Podcast, Mark.
And that is all of the news for this week. And that's all for episode 19. Thank you very much for listening. Next week, we will be discussing a deluge of Ubuntu remixes coming your way. If you'd like to chat with us in between shows, you can find us in the Ubuntu Podcast Telegram channel at ubuntupodcast.org/telegram. And if you are looking for a VPS, you can get the best VPSs in the UK from bitfolk.com.